will invite my friend Felipe, my new friend Felipe, to come up and present his summary of the four presentations in the dimension of his own synthesis, and then we'll have the four speakers sitting up here addressing your comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you. So, I mean, I think it's appropriate that this panel was left for last, not because it's least important, but as a political scientist and a biased person, because it's the most important. And I think what in the end happens is that a lot of things that were touched on in different ways come up again, but in a different perspective. But also a few things that weren't talked about during the course of events are highlighted in ways. And I think that the controversy is good, because it's controversy that's provocative, that gets us talking, and it gets us thinking in new ways. And in fact, what one of the themes that comes out of this panel is that the old is simply no longer good enough. Now, how people came to that realization depends on who you are or what you're looking at. But obviously, the huge price increase and the food crisis, the crisis of food insecurity from 2006 and 2007, then the austerity that was induced by the Great Recession of 2008, the emergence of new alternative sources of development finance, i.e., private sector and private sector foundations, the growing awareness of climate change and its impact, not only on food security, but on a variety of factors that are intimately linked with food security, all means that people realize, to one extent or another, that we got to do things differently. That what was old, whatever that achieved in the past, it's no longer enough. And in those terms, I think there are four things I'd like to highlight. First is that all of the speakers agree to a different extent and in different ways on a newfound and ultimately long in coming demand for accountability. Whether it be the World Bank that's needing to focus on new accountability measures in terms of how they account for the money they spend, or whether it be Annette on the other extreme talking about accountability in terms of our responsibility, moral or otherwise, to the poor and the hungry in the world, the idea here is we need to think about what's right and what's wrong in a way that policymakers always had in the back of their mind, but I think, and this is good, they can no longer ignore, whatever that means in practice. The second is, again, this is not new, but it's something that we're finally realizing, none too late, and that is this is a multidimensional problem. It's not only a technological problem, although that's a big part of it. It's technology plus. Global climate change, the need for sustainability, which always should have been there, is now recognized in a way that it never was, and the intimate link between poverty and all of the problems we're talking about. We've known this, at least in our heart of hearts, but now for the first time it's on the table. Holistic approaches are the only way to go. They're complicated, they're difficult, and that explains why we're having this conference here, because we haven't found the magic bullet, if there even is one. The third thing that comes out, and again in different ways and to different degrees, is that people matter. Now, obviously, when we're talking about food security, we're talking about people. But what the speakers in different ways remind us is that what we're talking about is your gender matters, although that didn't come out nearly as much as I might have thought it would in this panel. But more than that, what we're talking about is what you eat, how you live, where you live, and what your priorities are. And the only people that can decide priorities are the people that are confronting the decisions themselves. It's not something that can be taken for people. It's a decision that needs to be made by people. And implicit in the ideas of accountability and all the other issues that I think came up in different ways and to different degrees is the idea is you got to listen to the people who are actually suffering the consequences of food insecurity. And finally, my political science hat comes out. This is all what politics is about. Whether we talk in the form of justice or power, what we're really talking about at any level is distribution. How food is distributed or not distributed, the fact that if you're poor, you can never have food security. But as we learned in the last speech by Diana, it's also the near poor, people who are statistically not considered poor, who suffer just as much and maybe even more because they're off the radar than the people who are registered as statistically being poor. So I think we're going to have a really rich conversation here because I think that these different perspectives all complement each other. They come at the same problem in a variety of ways, but they ultimately end up with the basic same points, even if the degree and intensity of those points vary. So thank you, and now we're going to turn the floor over to you, the people. So questions, comments. So I guess and so I don't know what the practice was. Were you, do you one question at a time or you to collect. Yeah. So you can direct your question at specific people or the whole panel. We'll collect a round of three, I'll let them answer it, and we'll go for another round of three and keep going until we run out of time. Or holds up the red sign. So,
hi. Very interesting contrast between yesterday and today. Yesterday, the opening speech presented food security as a business opportunity. Today, it is presented as a human crisis, a human problem, and I think it's wonderful because yesterday we were led to believe that government should step aside and let business do their work. Today we're led to believe that no, government has an important role to defend the public health good. Business, of course, has a role, but government has an important role. And so I just want to congratulate the panel, and I believe that the panel today should have been the opening speech instead of a sales pitch that we've been served yesterday. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Rafia. I'm a medical student here at McGill, and I thought this panel was really interesting, especially because I guess for much of the day we've been hearing about how the hope lies in ingenuity and sort of private industry coming up with solutions to solve this crisis. And now we're hearing that there isn't a food shortage, it's a power redistribution. And I was wondering, a lot of these, for example, the Millennium Development Goals, or they're always framed in terms of what we can provide, or like we're always wondering what we can, how we can measure food scarcity. But I was wondering, Annette specifically, how would you measure food sovereignty, or how would you measure, measure up to how food sovereignty has improved?
Okay, over to my right. You're up.
Oh, hi. Felix van Gaia. I was trying to read my notes, actually. Diana, a couple of stats you threw my way are a little bit eye-opening. I think I really would like to address with Yuri and Chappie from Kenya, as well as also thank Annette very much for something very eye-opening. We seem to be back a little bit to the ideas of Amartya Sen, that actually we don't have a food production problem, we have a distribution problem. So this is kind of nothing new. But I'm just wondering, though, how true that is in some respects, because I think if you read like people like Lester, I won't say Lester Pearson, the Earth Policy Institute, Lester Brown, he often talks about we're kind of really only one crisis away from having a serious kind of like global food security problem. But I'm thinking more about the need to have ecosystem services. The World Bank obviously are interested in alleviating poverty, so agriculture is a way to doing that rather than just kind of alleviating hunger and addressing nutrition. You've got to alleviate poverty as well, as with Jim Yonkum back in June. But how are you actually going to pay for these ecosystem services? It's a conversation I was having with Tom Lovejoy a few years ago, and I would really like to know, how do we actually address this whole kind of gamut of things to actually get good ecosystem services so we can actually have food security and nutritional security? Thank you.
Okay, then one last question, because there's one last person standing for this round.
Yes, René Roy, PhD student in at McGill in agricultural economics. And I was wondering if the panelists could talk a bit more about policies to alleviate. We have heard a bit about it, but I would like to hear more about policies here and around the world that alleviate the problem of income distribution. Because as I read the text, the title of our conference, it's strategies against food insecurity. And we have heard a lot of things about improving productivities, but there is a big and a huge problem, as the panelists stressed, about improving the inequality or equality between people. So I would like to hear the panelists about that. Thank you.
So we'll start with you, Annette, and just go down.
Okay. Well, the first question that was directed directly at me was the question about whether how to measure food sovereignty. And I think that's a very interesting question. There's actually quite a bit of research that has been done recently by some colleagues in Spain on developing a whole set of food sovereignty indicators, which would do precisely that, you know, try to measure what food sovereignty looks like by using a whole series of different indicators. For example, whether or not there is land redistribution taking place in a given place. I mean, certainly one of the key aspects of food sovereignty is as I mentioned, an equitable access to and control over land-producing, food-producing resources. Well, land is absolutely key. And you know, I just came back from a week in Brazil where there was not one sentence made from all of the people on the various panels that I attended at this international conference where they did not mention agrarian reform. And, you know, the good thing is that agrarian reform is back, has been placed back on the international agenda. But I think that that's only because of the hard work that farm organizations, that peasant organizations, and researchers did together and to insist at the international level that agrarian reform be placed on the agenda, on the agriculture development agenda. So certainly that would be one of the indicators. There's a whole bunch of different indicators, but another one would be indicators that would allow us to take a really good look at how agricultural policy is developed at a national level. Not only look at who's sitting in the room, but what kind of process was developed to ensure that people's voices were actually heard. I mean, there's a real difference. You know, people talk about, well, empowerment. There's a whole lot of different definitions of what empowerment might mean. For example, you know, academics, government officials, and corporate executives could sit in a room in an isolated tower somewhere, develop a program, then organize a series of consultations to have people buy into their solution. That's a form of empowerment. That is often what it's being described as often in the international development circles. But a food sovereignty approach does not start with an already written document. You bring people together, farmers, academics, corporate executives, if they have to be in the room, and you start together to develop that a working document. So it starts from a different place, okay? So I could go on and on about the indicators, but just to let you know that there are people working on it, and I think it's really important work because it will allow us to actually start measuring, you know, how food sovereignty actually improves the well-being of different communities. And we need that research to be able to, you know, to argue for more support for a food sovereignty approach. The one other question had to do with the world population. I think we've heard it so many times. There's an increase in world human population, and therefore we need to double food production by such and such a year. Well, and it's also been the second person who spoke in the first panel this afternoon made it quite clear that that's not the issue, actually. The issue is that we're probably producing way too many grain-gobbling, methane-producing cows. And that's what we should be measuring. Why aren't we counting that population instead of being that concerned about human population? Let's talk about the pig population. Let's talk about the the cow population and the chicken population. That, and then when you start looking at, you know, because that's where all the grain is going, the world's grain production is going primarily to that kind of production. So I think that that needs to be turned on its head. And I think the wake up before it's too late study provides some really interesting data on that. Thanks.
Well, I don't think there was that much that was directed at me, but I think the on the question of the it's not food production but distribution, I mean, on one level, yes, fair enough, but the problem is also that we've taken out the middle of our food production system. So, for example, in Canada, those intermediate necessary pieces of the industry, such as local abattoirs or local processing facilities, have been hollowed out. And so, you know, we're sending our meat halfway across the country or all the way across the country in order to be packaged and to be sent back, all at tremendous greenhouse gas cost. You know, while I agree with the general statement that it's a problem of distribution and not production, we also have a job to do in rebuilding the middle of the food system if we are going to go where certainly polls and lots of studies show that people want to go to more local and sustainable kinds of food. That is definitely where the appetite is in this country. On the question of policies to alleviate the differences in income distribution, well, there's many answers to that, but I mean the big answer is what the first speaker said, it's about government. That's what governments are supposed to do. That's what our tax systems are supposed to do. And what we have in this country, and I would refer you to studies by the Broadbent Institute or by the CCPA or by the Parliamentary Budget Officer or by probably countless other groups, show that tax burden of the upper income levels has gone down dramatically, and it has increased dramatically on the middle class. Corporate taxes have gone way down, and small businesses are having trouble making ends meet, big corporate taxes. So I think those are really obvious things, and I think also that international institutions during the dogma years of structural adjustment had their share to pay in responsibility there by, you know, telling governments to get out of the way and deregulate and liberalize and open the way to compete with the world. So I guess I'll just leave it at that.
I think the questions were as diverse as probably the panel. So I'm not sure which one was directed at me or which one I can even answer. But the one thing that I wanted to say was on sort of what you had reflected on, this kind of dichotomy of, is it the availability of food or is it the distribution of food? And one thing that I have realized, at least in my institution, where I think we are more on the increased production camp as opposed to the let's increase distribution camp, is that we have surprisingly been very, very ignorant of consumption. It's just sort of been assumed that if we produce more, people will consume more. And I must say, I'm not saying I'm any better, but when I actually went back and looked at all of our agricultural projects and at their sort of completion reports, you know, we say great things, yields increased by so much, production increased by so much, sometimes they'll say income increased by so much by the farmers, and there is not one project where we said anything about consumption. And if you were to ask those people, that the task manager, the government partners that they work with, I'm sure they would say, well, income increased, so I'm sure they ate more. Maybe, but maybe not. So it's just a shocking sort of lack of awareness on our part, and that's what I think we can... looking at distribution is extremely hard, especially at the household level. I don't think we are the organization well equipped to do that. looking at intra-household power structures and whatnot, but at least looking at consumption. That seems like something we could do. And I think, Brent, you did your first presentation looking at food consumption indicators, dietary diversity, food consumption scores. I don't see why we can't do those. These have been validated. We just haven't. So this, I think, is something that I think that I have been taking away personally from all these discussions. The other thing that I wanted to say was the role of the private sector. Like it or not, in our institution, maybe this is not the right expression, but to a degree, we have to follow the money. And the money seems to be with the private sector these days. Aid money is drying up with the traditional donors. There are new entities coming on board, the Gates Foundation, China. Their aid is growing 25% a year, extremely high growth. But more so than any other of these sources, it's really the private sector. They now see that Africa, other parts of the developing world are emerging markets. That's how they see it. So they're willing to come into markets that they weren't willing to come into before. And as much as we at the World Bank talk about PPP, private-public partnerships and coordination with the private sector, to be honest, we don't really know how to do that very well. I mean, very bluntly and honestly, even within the World Bank, we have tremendous challenges working with the side of the World Bank that deals with the governments and the other side of the World Bank that deals with the companies. So we're embarking on that, but I think that's another area that we have to learn and calling upon the research community to tell us, what is this PPP model? I hear a lot about PPP models for infrastructure, but quite honestly, beyond outreach schemes, I don't really know what it is that we should be promoting. So those are my two observations.
There was one question that was directed at me. I think I will touch on the issue of food production. Yes, the production at the moment is not the issue, but the issue is the current production happening in a sustainable way that we can stay within the planetary boundaries? The answer is no. Therefore, how can we be able to ensure that we can continue to produce the food, but in such a way that we're not putting any pressure on our natural resources, on our ecosystems? Which I really think that in as much as at the moment the production steps or processes are happening and we're having food, we need to revisit and look at whether that production is really happening in such a way that we can continuously have harbor these increasing population and at the same time those ecosystems providing the services. Distribution, yes, is a problem, and that is why a lot of people are still hungry in communities, in villages, and that has to be addressed. But before that is addressed, I think that the production issue need to be looked into very detailed. And that's why in my presentation I indicated there are some success stories, but they're not happening at bigger scale. And therefore, that needs to be scaled up in such a way that the approaches which are ensuring that agricultural production happens in within planetary boundaries without getting out of that becomes the norm rather than the exception. On the issue of payment for ecosystem services, I think we just had a wonderful lunch, and in the morning we had coffee. We need to start asking the question, where is the water coming from? Is it this water is surely coming from a watershed in a small village in Gambia, in Togo, in Mozambique, in India? Who are these people in these villages? Are they being compensated? Absolutely not. So the payment for ecosystem services is a scheme, but is that scheme being exploited? Is it being taken into consideration into accounting services in countries? Unless this get mainstream into national accounting systems in countries so that GDP can start really recognizing these key services provided by ecosystems and at the same time also compensating those vulnerable people in communities, then we will have a serious issue with our food system in future. I think those contributions are the ones that are added to the discussion.
Okay, are there any other questions? We have some time left. Just walk up to the microphone.
Can I start?
Yes, please.
I wanted to ask a question about, in terms of shifting the paradigm for an NGO that is interested in working in that way, any suggestions about who the funders may be? I think we've heard from the World Bank, but I wonder if you have any ideas about that.
And then Kush?
The consensus that there is enough food. Okay, now we do not have to produce more food. That's not true. Is it sustainable food production? For example, we have a project in Colombia, and when we ask them what is the problem, we are very poor people. Our children are getting sick because for the potato production, we are applying fungicides every 4 days. And then you talk to some other, we are putting too much fertilizers. It's not producing anymore. So at what cost we are producing? When you take the ecology or ecosystem into consideration, we have to do a lot in the production system. Thank you.
Deanna, thank you very much for the eye-opening presentation. I had a question regarding land ownership and the very troubling statistics of Northern Canada food insecurity. So I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit more. Thank you.
In relation to land ownership?
Mainly reservations, right?
So, one more question I think we'll have time for.
Okay. Here. Okay.
Oh, I wasn't sure.
It's actually, well, I didn't know whether to take the prerogative of the chair or the prerogative of the people. So after listening to Deanna and to and Annette, I decided to become part of the people. And now see if my question reflects that. There are dangers in having excess production, aside from the issue of is it sustainable. And when we had too much corn production, we got creative as to what we could do with it and invented high fructose corn syrup, because that's something else, you know, value added, and biofuel value added, until there was a crunch in terms of total grains. But part of it was our technology led us just to find more value in it, and in clear health terms, what we found applied to our food system was not very healthy. So that's one of the dangers of having. Now, there's a brave new world aspect to both visions that we've heard in these 2 days. Last night's lecture had a vision, and the definition of food sovereignty projects a vision. But the brave new world aspect is that I think that neither, the full realization of neither, including food sovereignty, has never actually been seen. Because as I see that, all social classes, not only the poor, have been deprived of that process. So as we go forward, we're going forward to the enterprise where no one has gone before. And it seems like slavery or smallpox. There was a time up to which, in the history of the world, we'd always had slavery. Then in the 1880s, theoretically, it was gone. Or in the 1980s, smallpox, and it was gone. So as we're facing food in the future, I think by whatever vision, intensive farming or food sovereignty, we're moving into something where we have never gone before.
So I will throw the questions back to the panelists and for the last set of responses, the last words.
Sure. Okay, so the funders for the paradigm shift, gosh, I wish I knew the answer to that question. The fact is that there's a whole lot more money to not do the paradigm shift than there is to do the paradigm shift. But there are some very innovative food funders in this country. The organization that funds us is the J.W. McConnell Family Foundation that has quite an ambitious food program. And there are other small funders. And I'd be happy to talk to you about it afterwards if you like. It's in the nonprofit world, and particularly if you're not a charitable organization delivering frontline services, it's very, very, very tough to get money for this kind of work. I don't know the answer to the question of land ownership and food insecurity rates in Nunavut. I know where to tell you to get that answer, however, which would be ITK, the Inuit I'll just say ITK, it's the Inuit Land Claims Organization, and there's some people there who I can put you in touch with as well who are very very well qualified to answer that question. I think that's probably, but I do want to comment on the question of technology-led development. I spent three years working for an organization called Etc. Group. And one of the things that we tried to do was advocate, and we had a good talk about this last night over dinner, advocate for technology assessment so that it's not just any new technology on the block that needs to be deployed, but there needs to be accountable assessment of technologies for their social and environmental impacts before they are deployed. So we're not left with cleaning the mess up afterwards from cancer-causing chemicals or technologies gone bad. There's just too many stories of that, and we place all too much faith in new technologies. I think the problem of food insecurity is not fundamentally at all a technological problem. It is a social and economic problem. It is a human problem. And of course, technology can be part of the solution. Appropriate technologies, technologies that are decentralized at scale, appropriate technologies, not one size fits all. And I feel very strongly about that. And we have a number of emerging technologies on the horizon, synthetic biology and extreme kinds of genetic engineering, artificial life forms, nanotechnologies. They have not been adequately tested for their social and economic impacts, and they will have impacts, and they are having impacts on our food system already. And we've not used the precautionary principle. We've not used common sense. And this is really an area where governments need to take back control. Thank you.
Yeah, where will we get the money to actually shift the paradigm? Well, let's actually remember that there's actually a really, really interesting book written by an American, which is called "The Revolution Will Not Be Funded." Okay. And I think that there's some really, really interesting things to note about that. I mean, first of all, we're talking about a paradigm shift where public policies are key. We all pay taxes, and we all are demanding, if it's going to be a paradigm shift, we are all demanding something new, which will be paid for by our tax dollars. That's certainly a key part of the funding source. There are some interesting developments taking place. Some governments have actually introduced food sovereignty in their national constitution. Then the question is, as the woman who asked me about indicators, well, the question is, will that be followed by a series of laws and legislation that allows the country to then actually implement food sovereignty? So that's one important development. The other thing is that the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Council is actually debating an international declaration on peasants' rights. If that's accepted, then, and if governments sign up to it, then governments are legally bound by international law to develop legislation, national legislation, to then enable them to put those human rights to implement the human rights, to allow people the full realization of those rights. And the last thing I want to mention is that the Food and Agriculture Organization, just a couple of days ago, actually signed an agreement with the Via Campesina, because they're very interested in looking at the potential of food sovereignty in alleviating food insecurity.
And I think that this is a really important step, that the Food and Agriculture Organization has actually come to an agreement with one of the largest international peasant movements to sit at the table and actually start hashing out some of those possible solutions to the immense problems that we have. Thanks.
I think my contribution to this is pretty much building on what the two speakers have just mentioned. Governments have got to step up and create the enabling environment. I mean, the 2007-2008 riot as a result of food prices going up is a resounding reminder that the increasing population will definitely pose serious challenges to these two countries and governments as well. Therefore, investing in approaches that can create jobs, because the population of the African continent, for example, the youth population is increasing at a very rapid rate, and they will need jobs. And these jobs will have to be created at the same time feeding the number of mouths that have been added. Therefore, investing in these approaches, it's quite very, very vital to ensuring that job creation at the same time addressing food security can be addressed. But what needs to happen is that policies have got to be put in place. An enabling environment has got to be created to ensure that private sectors can also start engaging in this food security arena and addressing these challenges.
So I want to thank the panelists for provocative presentations. I want to thank the audience for provocative questions. Thank you.
It was fascinating stuff.
Oh. Thank you. It's a really small world. Yeah.